Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Eric Walker on behalf of Defendant Appellant Kathleen M. Arthur. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Arthur challenges her convictions for conspiracy to commit money laundering, receipt of debtor property, and filing a false claim in bankruptcy, as well as the order of forfeiture entered against her. Because there was insufficient evidence to support these convictions, they must be reversed. This appeal involves the important question of when transactions related to bankruptcy fraud constitute the additional and more severe crime of money laundering. The lower court drew the line too close in this case, essentially eliminating any distinction between the two offenses. First, there was insufficient evidence to show that the underlying bankruptcy fraud generated any proceeds. Second, there was insufficient evidence to show what, if any, profits were derived from those proceeds. And third, there is insufficient evidence that of Ms. Arthur's specific intent.
Counsel, I'm puzzled by this proceeds argument. What difference does it make? Your client received 54-month concurrent sentences on all counts. So who cares about a count or two?
Well, Your Honor, this is...
this appeal all about the $100 special assessment?
No, Your Honor. This appeal involves a number of things, including, number one, the order of forfeiture that was entered against Ms. Arthur for the money laundering convictions, which was in excess of $40,000. Number two, Ms. Arthur is still serving her sentence for supervised release. And number three, Ms. Arthur will have a substantially reduced criminal record, which could have a significant impact on her life to the extent that the court reverses these convictions. In the United States versus Santos, the Supreme Court affirmed this court's decision interpreting the term proceeds in the money laundering statute as profits and not gross receipts. That distinction is bedded in the concern that a money laundering transaction not merge with the underlying specified unlawful activity. Similarly, this court has repeatedly recognized that a money laundering transaction must be separate and distinct from the underlying criminal act, and that the money laundering statute...
Well, wasn't the money moved into a different bank account?
Your Honor, there were three charges. There are three counts for money laundering. Two of the counts include depositing checks into a bank account. The third count is the purchase of a CDU. However, the government charged as conspiracy to commit bankruptcy fraud those very acts. They are specifically listed as overt acts in furtherance of that bankruptcy fraud, and then they charge the very same transaction as money laundering, which is an...
What's wrong with that?
So what?
Because the money the law is fairly well established that a money laundering transaction must be separate and distinct from the underlying specified unlawful activity.
Where is that clearly established?
Well,
I understand the argument about Chialaba and Santos, but I don't think they establish the proposition that there must be separate acts. It's pretty common for one act to violate multiple criminal statutes.
That is true in many respects, Your Honor, with the exception of the money laundering statute. The money laundering statute expressly states that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, in this case, Ms. Arthur conducted a financial transaction involving the proceeds of a specified unlawful activity.
Yes.
And you have to list...
Why does that imply separate acts?
Because you must have one act, a specified unlawful activity, which generates proceeds that are then subsequently laundered. If there were no distinction between the two offenses, then every offense for bankruptcy fraud would also be an offense of money laundering and would subject the offender...
Might or might not. Depends on what has been done with the money. But take a drug case where the drug lord gets the money for selling a truckload of cocaine and puts it in his bank account. Do you think that can't be called money laundering because he got the money in the course of distributing the drugs?
It depends, Your Honor. If his deposit of the money into the bank account was part of the underlying drug offense, then no, that could not be the additional...
No, you're not dealing with my question. It's just, it's one set of acts, but, of course, being paid for drugs that you're distributing is not part of the crime. It's conceivable that, Harvard University could decide to start handing out cocaine for free, and that would be a violation of the drug laws, but wouldn't be money laundering because it was doing it for free. But usually, people commit crimes for money.
That's correct. However, if the court decides that any deposit of money that is generated from a specified unlawful activity, either drug trafficking, like Your Honor suggests, or in this case bankruptcy fraud, then any subsequent financial transaction, whether it's depositing money into account or, as under the bankruptcy statute, using third parties, using other deceptive means, structuring a transaction, having multiple transactions, then there really is no distinction between the two, and any subsequent financial transaction, charging a credit card, depositing money into a bank, would be subject to the additional and much more severe crime of money laundering, which would subject the offender to a significantly enhanced criminal
penalty.
But
isn't the bankruptcy fraud complete when the when the money is taken rather than what happens to it afterwards?
I think courts have struggled with that question, Your Honor.
I don't understand. What's the struggle?
Well,
I mean, if you rob a bank and you're running away with the money in your pocket, the robbery is complete, even though your intention is to run far enough to be able to deposit it.
That is true. The more narrow view is the first omission.
The robbery is obviously complete before the stolen money is deposited anywhere.
Even assuming that the bankruptcy fraud...
What do you mean, even assuming? Well, how could there be any doubt about that?
Say the bankruptcy fraud
is... The fraud is complete when you take the money. What you do with the money is something completely separate.
That's not the way the crime was charged in this case, Your Honor. In the indictment, the government has a choice on how it charges the indictment. In the indictment, it expressly lists as overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy to commit bankruptcy fraud the very same transactions that she was subsequently convicted of for money laundering. In this case, the government said the bankruptcy fraud was not complete until Ms. Arthur conducted these financial transactions. That was part of the underlying conspiracy. And then they used that same transaction and subsequently charged Ms. Arthur for the separate and more severe crime of money laundering. In fact, Congress has expressed this very same concern just last week.
Wait. It sounds like you've now taken the position that overt acts of an inchoate crime cannot be separately prosecuted.
As money laundering, that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, but why just as money laundering?
Because in money laundering...
Jones distributes drugs, and he conspires with 15 people to do so. And the indictment will list as overt acts some of the acts of distribution. Well, nothing is more common for them to be prosecuted as separate crimes. The overt acts of one conspiracy often are separate crimes.
That's correct, but with the money laundering statute...
Why is that true of money laundering?
Because you have to use the proceeds of a completed crime to conduct a separate financial transaction. And this...
Yes. And?
This court has been... In this case...
Smith and Jones conspire to distribute drugs, the indictment charges, and to hide the proceeds through a series of financial transactions so complex they hope it will escape detection. Now, why isn't that three crimes? There's the conspiracy, there's the distribution of drugs, and there's the hiding of the proceeds through a series of financial transactions so complex as to defy analysis. It sounds like three crimes to me.
It very well...
To you, it sounds like two crimes. Well, I could sort of understand the argument that it's only one crime, but I can't understand the argument that it's two crimes but not three crimes. So why is it two but not three?
It very well may be three, Your Honor, in that hypothetical. In this case, we don't need to wonder because the government listed as a specific overt act in furtherance of the bankruptcy.
Right, hypothetical.
Yes.
The government lists all the transactions involving the funds as an overt act.
Then the financial transactions that are listed as part of the drug conspiracy do not constitute a separate...
I don't understand why you're not saying there's only one crime, that the overt acts of the conspiracy can't be separate crimes. The reason you're not saying that is because you know full well it's not the law, and then I don't understand why money laundering is any different.
Because as this court has recognized, and as Congress just expressed its concern regarding this last week with the passage of the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act...
It expressed concern.
It did.
It enacted a statute.
Correct. And in Section 2G1 of that statute, which I believe is entitled Sense of Congress, it imposes additional restrictions on charging transactions as money laundering that are so closely connected with this specified unlawful activity. And that strikes at the very heart of the problem with Ms. Arthur's convictions in this case, which is The bankruptcy fraud included the same transactions for which he is subsequently charged with money laundering. In the United States versus Santos...
Well, I don't see it's the same. You mean they're the same? You mean they overlap? There's obviously dimensions to the bankruptcy fraud that are not part of money laundering.
Correct.
So and they overlap. So what? What are you worried about? What's the abuse here that concerns you?
Because there were certain transactions that the government charged and convicted and charged Ronald Arthur and Miss Arthur related to bankruptcy fraud. And there was these transactions included the deposit of the Thompson
right,
consulting
check.
I
understand that. But what is it? What is the abuse that you're concerned about?
Because if there is no clear distinction between the underlying bankruptcy fraud...
But there
fraud,
is a distinction. There's a distinction between a bankruptcy fraud and money laundering. So she's punished for the bankruptcy fraud, whatever form it takes, which could include money laundering. But then she's also committed this crime of money laundering, so she's punished for that.
But it's the same transaction.
No, it's it, what? So what? It, look, it, if she were punished for the bankruptcy fraud, if she were given a sentence for bankruptcy fraud because it involved money laundering, heavy sentence, and then she was separately sentenced for money laundering, that would be a problem. But if she's just sentenced for bankruptcy fraud without any bonus because it involved money laundering, and then she's separately punished for the money laundering, where is the abuse or injustice?
The problem is that in any case...
Where is the abuse or injustice? As long as she's not punished twice for money laundering, but just once for money laundering and once for bankruptcy fraud, where is the injustice?
Because she's being punished twice under two separate statutes.
No, she's not being punished twice in my example. She's punished. She's given one sentence for bankruptcy fraud, and then she's given another sentence on top of it for money laundering. There's no double sentencing.
And if the court affirms her conviction in that case, then any bankruptcy fraud which involves a financial transaction will be subject to the additional and much more severe crime
of money
laundering.
No, you don't understand. Suppose the maximum sentence for bankruptcy fraud is 1 year, and for money laundering it's 10 years. So she's sentenced for 1 year on for bankruptcy fraud plus 10 years for money laundering is 11. Now, what difference does it make as long as she gets 11 and not, 21? That the money laundering was also charged as part of the bankruptcy fraud, as well as being a separate crime. If it didn't lead to a bigger sentence, what's the problem?
Because she didn't commit money laundering, Your Honor. I see that. I would like
didn't
to.
Didn't commit money laundering.
She at
That's
most.
A separate issue. The question is, if she committed money laundering, and it's charged both as money laundering and as part of a bankruptcy fraud, what is the injustice as long as she's not sentenced more than once for money laundering?
Because she's sentenced for a crime she didn't commit. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
What are you talking about? That's a separate issue, whether she committed money laundering. That's separate from your your overlap problem. Your overlap problem has nothing to do with punishing people for crimes they didn't commit.
The overlap identifies or highlights or underscores the fact that Miss Arthur did not commit money laundering. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
I don't understand you. You're saying that if she's charged with bankruptcy fraud that involves money laundering, she can't have committed money laundering?
If she is charged for bankruptcy fraud for one transaction, she cannot subsequently be charged for money laundering for the exact same transaction. Because the money laundering statute requires her to use the proceeds of a specified unlawful activity. And then
This has nothing to do with double sentencing.
No, Your Honor, this has to do
with... This is just technical nonsense.
But it's important that the government have to satisfy all of the essential elements
of
the crime.
What are you protecting? What interest are you protecting?
Miss Arthur's interest for being convicted of...
Right.
A sentence for a crime which she didn't commit.
Would you be happy, by the way, if the prosecutor dismissed the bankruptcy fraud conviction and just left the money laundering conviction in place?
No, Your Honor. The government would still have the same issue of showing that for money laundering, Ms. Arthur engaged in a financial transaction dealing with the proceeds from a specified unlawful activity. They would still have the burden.
As Judge Posner said, that's just an argument about the sufficiency of the evidence. One always
that's
has
correct.
To show that all of the elements of a particular offense have been committed.
That's exactly
right. But at that point, it doesn't have anything to do with whether bankruptcy fraud was charged or convicted or anything else.
No. It doesn't. Your Honor, I see my time is up if I could answer your question.
Mm-hmm.
It does not have to do with whether or not the government charged it generally. But in this case, it is easy because as part of the bankruptcy fraud charge, the government specifically lists the very same transaction for which Ms. Arthur was convicted of money laundering.
Well, that's the pit that you don't want to step into. Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Thank you very much.
John Pietro.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Gordon Jim Pietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States in this case. I'd like to make my argument today proceed from what I consider to be the simplest arguments to maybe the more interesting ones. But, Judge Easterbrook, I would like to address your initial question to Mr. Walker, which is why does any of this matter? It's important to point out that it doesn't matter at all with respect to count one, which is the conspiracy under 371. That was not part and parcel of the defendant's appeal in this case. Mrs. Arthur received a sentence of a year and a day, so she's well within the 5 years statutory maximum for the 371 conspiracy. So really the discussions today about money laundering are, in a sense, academic, with the exception of the forfeiture. Mr. Walker.
Do you agree with Mr. Walker that the forfeiture depends on the money laundering conviction?
That's correct, Your Honor. Right. Proceeding from count one, I'd like to then now address count 16, which is the false claim in bankruptcy. Essentially, the argument here is that there's no evidence in the record that Mrs. Arthur performed legal or management services that would justify her $650,000 claim in her husband's bankruptcy. The reply brief mentions a letter that was submitted at sentencing that suggests that Mrs. Arthur had done some work with respect to this Project Heat charitable endeavor that the Arthurs had. There are really three problems with that argument. First, it's evidence that was submitted at sentencing. It was not evidence presented to the finder of fact, and so Judge Adelman really was stuck with just Mrs. Arthur's testimony as to what services she may or may not have provided to Mr. Arthur. Second, the fact that Mrs. Arthur did participate in this charitable endeavor does not mean that there was an agreement that Mr. Arthur would pay her for those services. So, again, we're left with the trial evidence, which is her own testimony, as to the legitimacy of the claim in bankruptcy, and certainly Judge Adelman, having found that she perjured herself in a number of respects, was entitled to find that there was sufficient evidence to convict her of filing a false claim under count 16. Turning then to the counts that deal with receipt of debt or property, counts 11, 12, and 14, these counts, again, unrelated to the money laundering counts, really rise or fall on Judge Adelman's determination that the marital property agreements were a sham. In her reply brief, Mrs. Arthur argues that there's evidence in the record that these agreements were created years prior to the bankruptcy. Actually, the record in this case doesn't support that assertion at all. In fact, there's significant circumstantial evidence that they weren't created until sometime perhaps even after the filing of the bankruptcy. The only transactions that occurred in this case that are consistent, and I say consistent because they don't demonstrate an agreement was in place, were the transfers of real property that took place in May of 1997 from Mr. Arthur to Mrs. Arthur. Those were simply transactions whereby Mr. Arthur was divesting himself of interest to avoid Mrs. Doyle's judgment that she obtained in Juneau County decision. The marital property agreements that were introduced into evidence were not, in fact, publicly filed anywhere until April of 2001, well after the bankruptcy had been filed, and importantly, after the trustee at the 341 hearing in September of 2000 demanded that Mr. Arthur produce any documents related to transactions or transfers between Mr. and Mrs. Arthur within 4 years before the filing of the 2000 bankruptcy. At that point, it became apparent to Mr. Arthur that when he did bring forth these marital property agreements, they needed to be dated in 1995, and sure enough, they were in fact dated in 1995, and that was one of the bases upon which Judge Adelman found that they were not credible and that they were sham documents. I won't go over the record evidence with respect to how the defendants did not act in conformity with those marital property agreements. I will simply say
Are you going to respond to Mr. Walker's argument?
I will, with respect to Santos, Your Honor. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, his whole argument was about this, you know, overlap between bankruptcy fraud and money laundering.
I will, Judge. I will discuss that, in fact, right now. That relates to the Santos argument under counts 24 through 26. First, I would point out, I think, that issue comes before this court under plain error review. Shalabi was not brought to the attention of the district court. The evidence in this case did not...
Shalabi.
Which, in fact, obviously Santos had not yet been decided when this case went to trial. But because Mr. and Mrs. Arthur did not present these as jury instructions to the district...
Our decision in Santos had been released before this trial.
I'm not certain, Judge. The trial in this case was in 2005, and I believe Santos is 2006. But in any event, Santos is not materially different from the earlier case. So the question of net versus gross proceeds certainly was part of this court's jurisprudence at the time of trial. I admit that. With respect to this question of merger, this is not the sort of business-like crime that was at issue in Santos. The false oaths in bankruptcy occurred when the bankruptcy petition was filed in March of 2000 in Virginia. They are reaffirmed as charged in count three at the 341 hearing in September when Mr. Arthur affirms that his petition and schedules were true and complete. So I don't see at all the sort of merger problem that animates those decisions. The financial transactions that are charged as money laundering have nothing whatsoever to do with his false oaths in the bankruptcy proceeding, both in the petition and then in the 341 hearing. Judge Posner, I just reject the notion that there's overlap at all. I think we have clearly distinct crimes here, the false oath and account, and then the subsequent financial transactions. And I say the words subsequent financial transactions, which is probably not accurate, because...
Well, count 24, whatever you said? What did it say about... Did the bankruptcy fraud count, did that count mention the money laundering?
If memory serves me correctly, Your Honor, some of the overt acts, and there were a number listed with respect to the conspiracy count, a number of them were listed that then show up again as financial
transactions. Well, that's the overlap that he argues. So why do you say they have nothing to do with each other?
Well, when I say they have nothing to do with each other, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that the merger problem that animates the Santos decision doesn't exist here, because the financial transactions did not, in fact, to prove the false oaths that were charged in counts 3 through 10, it wasn't essential that those financial transactions take place. Those false oaths and accounts stand on their own. Mr. Arthur committed those crimes.
Well, then why are they listed as overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy?
They're in furtherance of the conspiracy charged in count 1, I believe, 371. They're not listed, I don't believe, as overt acts, because there are no overt act requirements for purposes of the money laundering conspiracy.
Argument is that when money laundering is an overt act, it can't be separately charged because it's part of the conspiracy that it is an overt act in furtherance of.
I'm just aware of no case law that supports that argument. I don't understand why there's an injustice, because the sentences for all the convictions were made concurrent in this case in any event. So I don't see the injustice in the fact that the overt acts are charged as separate money laundering counts. That's my only response.
So there are no cases dealing with this issue?
Not that I'm aware of, no, Your Honor. In her reply brief at page 4, Mrs. Arthur makes the argument that because the money laundering transactions in counts 24 and 25 predate the false oath charged in count 3, that cannot be money laundering. He cites a district court case from California. It's not an accurate statement of the law in this district. In the United States versus Seward, S-E-W-A-R-D, it's a 2001 case, this court said that the underlying SUA, the specified unlawful activity, does not have to have been completed before the financial transactions take place that give rise to the money laundering. and the cite for that case is 272 F3rd 831. I will say that that issue of whether it predates or postdates the false oath relates only to counts 24 and 25, not count 26. Count 26 is a financial transaction that took place well after the false oath and accounts. I will be happy to address, if the court wishes, the interplay of the recently passed FIRA and my plain error analysis. I would simply point out that when the financial transactions or the money laundering took place in this case, it predated this court's decisions in Scalaba and Santos, and now we're on appeal, and the Congress has clarified, as this court knows, its view of gross versus net proceeds, and under plain error, it would seem that the integrity and the fairness of the judicial proceedings would not be undermined by affirming the convictions, even if this court agrees with Mrs. Arthur that the Santos line of cases applies to the crime of bankruptcy fraud. If there are no further questions, I will rest on my brief.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Walker, we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm not sure I'd take it if I were you. Let's go ahead.
Can I say I'm a punishment?
Your Honor, Mr. Giampietro cites case law from this circuit stating that the underlying offense need not be completed in order to generate proceeds. While that is true, Ronald Arthur's false oaths hadn't started. The offense hadn't started until at least 2 months after Ms. Arthur had participated in at least two of the transactions. Indeed, Ronald Arthur's bankruptcy case hadn't been transferred to this district until August, when Ms. Arthur deposited the Thompson Consulting check in May of 2000, and the purchase of the CDU occurred in the middle of June. Therefore, it's anachronistic to say that Ms. Arthur engaged in a financial transaction involving the proceeds from Ronald Arthur's false oaths that wouldn't be committed for at least two additional months. Additionally, this case strikes at the very heart of the merger concern that is well established in this court's jurisprudence, as well as was recently enumerated by the Supreme Court in Santos. The merger problem focuses on whether or not the money laundering transaction is separate and distinct from the underlying criminal activity. Your Honor, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And Mr. Walker, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.